24th to July 3rd, the 20th annual Vancouver International Jazz Festival electrifies the city with great sounds from around the world. For 10 music-filled days, over 1,800 artists take to the streets, major theaters, outdoor stages, and nightclubs of Vancouver, over 40 venues in all. From the free street party on Water Street in Gastown, to the Center for Performing Arts, from hip clubs like the Ironworks, to great concert halls like the Orpheum Theater and the Commodore, jazz of all styles and stripes, blues, funk, soul, Latin, fusion, electronica, and world beat will resonate throughout the city. Madeleine Peru, Daniel Lanois, Roscoe Mitchell, The Bad Plus, Mavis Staples, Rachid Taha, Arturo Sandoval, The Herbalizer, and Dave Holland are just a few of the many great artists appearing. The Vancouver International Jazz Festival, June 24th to July 3rd. For tickets and information, call the Jazz Hotline at 604-872-5200 or log on to coastaljazz.ca.
And it's just after 12 o'clock, and you are tuned to CFRO, Vancouver's Cooperative Radio, 102.7 FM. Coming up right now, Animal Voices.
CFRO 102.7 FM. Welcome to Animal Voices, the weekly program that focuses on animal issues in the hope that by increasing knowledge and understanding of our fellow creatures, greater compassion for them will emerge. Animal Voices is a cooperative effort by three local groups, Animal Defense and Anti-Vivisection Society, Earth Save Canada, and the Vancouver Humane Society. Views expressed on this show are not necessarily supported by the cooperating organizations. My name is Marge Adams, and in the studio with me are co-host John Pranger and technician Alan Jensen. Our regular participant and co-host, Carl Loskin, is taking a well-earned day off. For the last several weeks, Carl has labored tirelessly on the Animal Voices Film Festival, which was held last Sunday at the Vancouver East Cultural Center. He was the driving force behind the production, which was presented by CETFA, Canadians for Ethical Treatment of Food Animals. That event was educational, entertaining, and very well attended. Dana Lyons, who was a guest on this show last week, was an inspiration. He played and sang several of his own songs, including Cows with Guns and Swimming in the Big, which we'll be playing later on in this show. Now, our first guest today is Barbara Murray, who is a North Shore Bear Advocate and a member of the International Bear Association. We will be speaking with Barbara Murray at the beginning of the show, about grizzly bear and black bears living in the North Shore District. Now, there's a second guest coming up in part two, which John, whom John will be telling you about right now.
Yes, we'll be talking to Alexandra Morton of the Raincoast Research Society. She's suing the government over the sea lice outbreaks on fish farms, which threaten the wild fisheries. The Raincoast Research Society was founded in 1981 to conduct year-round research on the acoustics of the orca of the BC coast. But over the years, the mandate of this society has broadened quite a bit. In 1987, the first corporate fish farms arrived in the archipelago, and in a few short years, huge problems began to appear, including toxic blooms and explosive disease and parasite events in salmon, hundreds of seals and sea lions shot. So we'll be talking to her about her lawsuit and other information about the harms that fish farms do.
Now, that will be coming up in the second part of the show. So right now we have Barbara Murray on the line, and she is our North Shore Bear Advocate. Welcome to Animal Voices, Barbara.
Oh, thank you, Marg. It's nice to be with you here.
Wonderful to have you.
Yes.
Bears have been in the news quite a lot lately, and
yes.
Tragically, a woman was killed in Canmore, Alberta, by a grizzly.
Yes.
And there were a couple of incidents of bear maulings in northern British Columbia. Fortunately for us, there were no serious injuries as a result of the maulings, but it is a big concern, and so that maybe you could tell us a little bit about events. Are they happening more frequently now? Or
Mark, just to let the viewers know that, you know, bear attacks are very rare. This is very rare that we would hear of three within 2 weeks' time. That's just... That's a huge number, actually, for us. I'll just give you a couple of statistics that you might be interested in. In North America, in the 90s, the whole decade went by, there was 29 people killed by bears. 18 of them were by grizzly bears, and 11 were by black bears. So that's about an average of two bears by grizzlies a year in all of North America, and about a half a person every year, or one person every 2 years for black bears. And that statistic has been pretty stable over the last few decades. So we're not going up from there. Hopefully, we are learning more and more about the bears, and that's what really is our best defense.
I see. What is the usual cause for such incidents when they do occur? Can you give us any idea?
Well, you know, Dr. Stephen Herrero has written, really documented the attacks in his bear attacks book that came out in 2002, his most recent. And, you know, a lot of times it's just bears coming into contact with people for the wrong reasons. Mostly the bears are looking for human foods. Not the humans themselves, but the foods that the humans are carrying with them, if it's in bear country or storing in their camper or outside in their home or where they dwell. That is most usually the cause of why bears and people are interacting in the first place, and therefore with those interactions, then sometimes you have serious consequences happening.
Right. And there has been a big drive on now for years to educate people about that, food, not leaving food accessible for the bears.
Yes, I have worked very hard on the North Shore with many other very passionate volunteers, hardworking volunteers, to try to get the North Shore bear smart. We really haven't quite got there yet. We need the municipalities to bring forward legislation so that waste containment is done as responsibly by both commercial and residential dwellers as possible, to just remove those attractants from the bears so that they're not being attracted in and coming close to people. We shouldn't be seeing bears in our backyard. I did want to just say at the beginning of your introduction, you mentioned grizzly bears on North Shore. We haven't had grizzly bears on the North Shore for 50 or 60 years, I believe, but we do have a couple of captive grizzlies on Grouse Mountain, which we can talk about later, but we're mainly dealing here with black bears.
Now, thank you for that, Barbara. Is the bear population diminishing on the North Shore?
No.
Uh-huh.
We have a very healthy, bear population. Since 1999, we lost over 40 bears. I've heard up to 60 bears between Lions Bay and Deep Cove in one fell swoop. It was a very bad bear year, so the authorities came in. There was a zero tolerance to bears being around people at that time, and that was only about 6 years ago. So the bears were killed. A couple of, you know, a few were relocated, but there was just no tolerance for bears. So we lost most of our resident bear population that was living close to us at the time. And since that time, it has been increasing. The population has come up. We have, I would say, anywhere from 50 to 60 bears on the North Shore, in the North Shore Mountains. And about half of those have started to make their way back into residential areas.
Mm-hmm. Now, in B.C., we do have grizzlies.
Can
you give us an idea of the population of
the
grizzlies?
We're one of the few places that is fortunate enough to have grizzlies. We have, over in North America, there's, just to give you some more stats, Mark, is 600,000 black bears in North America, approximately 60,000 grizzly bears. Okay, and in B.C., they're listed as a vulnerable species. In Alberta, they're listed as a species at risk, and I believe they should be listed as an endangered species there. They only have 700 of them left, if you can believe it. But in B.C., we estimate anywhere from, in the black bear range, anywhere from 60,000 to 120,000. And because the black bears are not a species at risk, there's been really no good, hard studies done on black bears in B.C., especially in the counting. And then the grizzly bears have been a little bit better counted, but we're still, the gap is pretty wide. The conservationists agree that there's about 8,000 grizzly bears left in B.C., and the government statistics would tell us there's 16,000.
So quite a range there.
Yeah, so you can take somewhere in the middle, and we might be getting close.
There is still hunting going on, allowed.
Yes, in B.C. and Alberta, both black bears and grizzly bears are hunted, and there are spring hunts. Grizzly bears are monitored much closer. They sell a limited supply of tags, grizzly bear tags in B.C., but there's still at least, I think, 300 tags sold. And I believe anywhere from 1 year to the next, the 200 to 400 grizzlies can be taken by hunters legally. That doesn't include the ones that are poached, the grizzly bears that are poached, and it sure doesn't include about 400 grizzlies that are killed on the highways and another... 300 to 400 that are killed as nuisance bears in the province every year.
300 to 400.
And then the black bear statistics are phenomenal. I mean, it's 400 killed on the road. I think there's at least 4,000 killed legally. And then we expect the international organizations to tell us that we probably have at least another double that for poaching, another 4,000 or 5,000 poached. And then, of course, you have, the hunting, which... I mean, the nuisance bears, which is 1,000 a year that are killed on average.
Mm, so that's a big whop of the population, it
the
seems to me.
The bears are most precious, I think, keystone species, and sometimes we don't treat them that way.
Now, poaching is an issue that is a concern. Maybe you could just tell us a little bit about why these animals are poached.
Well, poaching in Canada and the U.S. has been going on for a long time because of the Asian medical trade or medicine that they use the gallbladder bile from, and also they use bear paws for soup and medicinal purposes. The gallbladder bile does have medicinal properties, but it has been very successfully synthesized, by man. So there's no reason really to have bear bile farms like in China and whatnot, and those are being closed down. Thank goodness, but that also puts the pressure on our wild bears when the commercial places are being closed in other countries. So Korea, Japan, China, the Asian market is huge. Even our local markets are very huge, and of course it's underground markets, but they're very much alive and well, unfortunately.
They must bring in a lot of money.
Yes, a gallbladder, I believe, in the downtown Vancouver area, in Vancouver can... I've heard as much as $1,000 for an adult gallbladder, and then they do pay for adult paws and things. So that and other parts. So it's very lucrative. And I've heard after they've been traded over and over again, a bear can be worth about $10,000 to the Asian market.
So people are willing to take risk.
Very much so, and also hide their tracks. It's very hard to catch a poacher. I know that federal government's working hard. And they've been successful in Quebec and Ontario. BC they've been trying, but they haven't. I don't think there's been more than one or two small prosecutions, but we really do have to get to the bottom of what's going on there.
Another issue that's a current one, in, at least in my mind, mm-hmm. is the impact of recreational facilities. For example, in Grouse Mountain, and particularly Whistler, mm-hmm. Because of the Olympics coming up, of course. Is that having and going to have a big effect on the wildlife population?
Well, Whistler has put a huge value on their live bears. So they have bear viewing, and they're making a huge enterprise. So this awful expression, if it pays, you know, if it pays, it stays. So, you know, if they do it right, if they're educating the public and the tourists and people coming to their facility in a proper way and show bears in their as natural habitat as possible and caution people that bears are a dangerous wildlife, they need to be respected and stayed well away from, view from a safe distance, take all the precautions, and learn about bears, that's a good thing. That can only help our more wild bears that are further into the wilds and shouldn't be accessed by people, and we do need to cut off a lot of accesses to them. So if they can represent our wildlife in a proper way, that's wonderful. So I'm hoping 2010 will bring good things. I'm hoping a bear will be our mascot for the Olympics, and we just have a really responsible message out there. Now, Grouse Mountain has a refuge for endangered species, and I'm working very hard to actually have the authorities look at that refuge much closer with an inquiry, actually, because they do have two grizzly bears in captivity, and the owners of Grouse also have a Kicking Horse resort over in Golden that also house one grizzly now. They did lose a grizzly last winter in the den in 2004, so we're concerned that that might continue to happen. So we need that messaging to be looked at very closely and what they're teaching the people that go out and watch these animals in captivity there.
So are they actually benefiting financially from the wildlife then?
Oh, of course, yes. It is a commercial enterprise in every way. There are ski mountains in the winter, and the refuge is a place where the tourists and the school children go and learn about wildlife. And they try to put it in the most natural setting as possible. But the wildlife is restricted by electric fences. They're fed anything from dog food to natural food, you know, and the tourists can go around their whole enclosure and see them from afar or very, very much up close.
So they're paying an entry fee to see these animals,
course.
I guess. Yeah,
yeah, yeah,
I see.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's for entertainment purposes.
There are laws, legislation about keeping native animals, so they have to have permits, I suppose.
That's one of the big inquiry, purpose of the inquiry. What kind of permits do they actually hold? I do know there's really, I believe the only permit that Grouse holds at the moment is something under the Wildlife Act called possession of live wildlife. So that doesn't have a lot of rules around that, so they're pretty much open to how they handle that live wildlife.
Possession, a certificate to possess wildlife. That does sound awfully broad, doesn't it?
It's very broad. I understand they don't really have a classification of as you know, holding animals in a zoo, and this is how you do it, and this is how they should be treated, and you know, that you're going to be monitored by government agents or, you know, an unbiased observer. Like, it just, yeah, it doesn't make any sense to me. And the bear rehabbers and bear experts that I speak to, they really don't have any input into a facility such as Grouse and Kicking Horse. And that's a real concern for us. So we really want to go back to the government, have them look at their regulations and their permits and what they're issuing, and hopefully we can change that so there's, you know, just no mishaps in the future, and that the animals are kept as well as they can be in captivity.
Right, and this is under the province, isn't
this
it?
This is provincial. Now, the district in North Vancouver, I'm hoping it comes up this Monday night. It might be forestalled till the 20th, but there is a motion on the floor to look at their permits for land usage for Grouse Mountain, because Grouse Mountain would also like to expand and include rehabilitation facilities for black bears. And that's even a bigger concern. So if they were to be given a different kind of permit called the rehabber's permit, rehabilitation permit, where they hold and then release the animals at a young age, that could open up a whole another avenue for neglect or possible you know, problems in the future.
Maybe long-term captivity as well.
Possibly, if the rehabber looks at an animal and says that they're not deemed suitable for release because they're too friendly toward people or whatever, either that animal usually is euthanized in a rehab center, but if they do things wrong, there might be more of those unreleasable animals, and of course the public would have an outcry if they heard of a public facility such as Grouse having to euthanize animals. It wouldn't happen, so they would go into captivity, I believe.
There have been a couple of incidents, I think, with these animals in captivity under the care of corporations.
Yeah.
Kicking Horse is one, isn't it, mm-hmm. you mentioned, in Grouse Mountain. Can you tell us about that?
Well, it's they've just started in 2001. It's been a short time, but they have lost Carrie, a grizzly bear that came from the caribou, from Quinnell, after the mother was killed. So Carrie and Boo went to Kicking Horse after a year at Grouse, and Carrie, did die in the den the first season of a twisted intestine. So we do know that it was a twisted intestine. He was a healthy bear otherwise, but we are wondering about the husbandry kind of practices and what how they den, and were they truly locking the bears in the den, or we need to get to the bottom of this. So there's a lot of suspicions and rumors floating around and some news reports that we can go to, but we really would like to sit down with all the stakeholders involved and get to the bottom of this. And also there was a bear, recently 2 weeks ago, an alpha wolf was killed by Grinder, the grizzly up at Grouse Mountain. So that was quite shocking news for everyone.
Yes, and both of these species were in one enclosure.
Yes.
Could you tell us a little bit about the size of the enclosure and so on?
Well, I understand it's 5 acres total, but it is sectioned off into two sections, so it's two and a half and two and a half. I believe at that time, the 6 days before the mishap, the grizzly bears were separated by this separate line, hotline they call it, electric fence, from four gray wolves. And then 6 days before the mishap, the gray wolves were introduced into the grizzly pen, so I believe it was two and a half. But anyway, 5 acres to a grizzly bear is nothing. And then 5 acres even to grizzly bears and wolves is really tiny. So the two species were there, and they are, Canada's and North America's greatest predator species, and they were put together. And one species had a bone, and it was, whether it was a toy thing or a food item, it treasured that item, and it had been in, I guess the bone had been overlooked by the staff, and it had been in the enclosure for quite a while. And Grinder, who is the dominant male of the two, he just chose to take exception to the alpha wolf trying to get to his bone.
And there was no escape hatch for the wolf.
Nope, there was, and I don't think the wolf even realized the danger he was in, because he was a semi-tame wolf from the movie industry, for heaven's sake. So it just, this cannot be touted as an educational experience, putting these animals together. And the people that had to witness this event, it must have been very disturbing. This does not happen in the wild. Very, very seldom does a wolf tangle with a grizzly bear. Sometimes, if there's lots and lots of food around, you will see them close together, and the wolf will pick up where the grizzlies left off, but very seldom. Usually in the winter, like my rehabbers in the north tell me, they see the wolves running around all over the place, and then as soon as those grizzlies and black bears come out of their den, especially the grizzly bears, those wolves scatter. They're nowhere to be seen. Mm-hmm. They keep a pretty low profile.
Now we're running out of time,
yeah.
Could we just mention the motion? What is the District of North Coquitlam hoping? North Vancouver,
yeah.
Hoping to get out of this motion that's going to be brought forward next week.
Well, it's really a great first step for everyone, for us to go forward with the district, hopefully in full support, to the province when the minister is finally appointed, and ask for a review of Grouse and Kicking Horse, especially Grouse, because their district does hold permits for land usage. And they are in partnership, in a way, with the Grouse Mountain Enterprise. So if they feel that something isn't quite right, they should be able to speak up and also go forward with us to the province and speak even louder. So that's one thing. And And if people want to know more about this issue, they can go to www.animaladvocates.com. And we've posted quite a bit of information on both the district and the news articles and letters that have been written in by the public and people like ZooCheck. And we've got quite a bit of support building.
Okay, one last question.
Yes.
Is there anything the listeners can do to help the bears?
Well, you know,
other than not letting food be out in their reach.
Read as much as you can about bears. Stephen Herrero's book. We've got Kevin Van Tighem, Bears. It's the Altitude Publishing Guide. It's excellent. And then you can go to bearsmart.com. Write letters whenever, you know, you're at your computer. Always, you know, send a letter to Premier Campbell. Send a letter to your MLA or your municipality and just say how much you value all wildlife, not just bears, and that we have to protect it. We have to put signs on our highways. We have to have proper waste control for every animal, whether it's, you know, a raccoon or a bear or a cougar. And we just have to be really aware. So just having that value placed on the wildlife is the first thing the politicians and the government has to hear to go forward.
Great idea. Now, John wants to get one question in.
Yeah, that was extremely well said, all that you've said. The young woman who met the bear in Cranmore,
Yes. She
tried to escape by climbing up a tree, which is probably a good thing to escape a grizzly, isn't it? And yet the grizzly managed to claw her down.
That is one thing. You know, grizzlies can climb trees. Sometimes
people think
they can't. They're not very good at it because they have such long claws. Black bears are like squirrels. They have the really good climbing claws. But every bear is they're very different. They're highly evolved individuals. So nothing is 100% on advice. But I would say a bear attack, you know, a grizzly bear is quite different than a black bear. So, you know, she could have done two things. She could have either tried the tree, and unfortunately that didn't work. Then I'm sure she probably did try to play dead. And that's number one for a grizzly. If they're on top of you, just cover you're on your stomach, cover your neck by your hands, behind your head, and just stay as still as you can so the bear realizes you're not a threat and you really shouldn't be bothered with. A black bear, you fight like heck if you're in that situation with a black bear. Just fight, punch him in the nose, you know, sticks, stones. But a grizzly bear, you would just incite more possibly malicious, you know, or defensive behavior because they usually are acting defensively when they're attacking. But, you know, I always say if you see a bear on a trail, black or grizzly, stay calm, stand still, speak softly and slowly back away. And if that bear does come towards you, which is a big no-no, if it does come towards you, you stand your ground, you speak firmly, and you make yourself look bigger. And you hope like heck the bear realizes that, you know, you just shouldn't be challenged and he doesn't really want a conflict with you.
Oh, thank you so much for that, Barbara. That sounds like excellent advice.
Okay.
And thank you for speaking with us today, and I'd like to bless you for helping bears.
Well, thank you so much for your program and all your work.
Thank you. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You have been listening to an interview with Barbara Murray, a North Shore advocate for bears. And now we're going to have a little bit of music. Alan is going to play a piece by Dana Lyons, Swimming in the Big.
My portfolio is high. I'm going on vacation anywhere I wanna. I put it on my card. I could use a little sun and to see some ancient ruins. The pyramids are calling, off to Egypt I will fly. I go swimming in the big Egyptian river, bathing in the waters of the Nile. The sun is shining down and everybody's happy. Bathing in the waters of the Nile. My job is so secure and my government is stable. The weather's getting better, a little warmer every year. And now we've got free trade and everyone will prosper. The locals here are happy. I think I'll have another beer. Let's go swimming now. We're swimming in the big Egyptian river. Bathing in the waters of the Nile. The sun is shining down and everybody's happy. Bathing in the waters of the Nile. I thought I heard a bomb. It must be a celebration. If anything was wrong, they tell me on TV. Sometimes I am amazed how perfect things are going. I think I'll do some shopping and take a little time for me. Everybody's doing it. We're swimming in the big Egyptian river.
Backstroke, breaststroke, sidestroke, crawl.
Bathing in the waters of the Nile.
He's got it all.
The sun is shining down and everybody's happy.
Happy, he's so happy, happy.
Bathing in the waters of the Nile. Oh yeah, everybody's doing it. We're swimming in the big Egyptian river.
Breaststroke, sidestroke, crawl.
Bathing in the waters of the Nile.
He's got it. He's got it all.
The sun's shining down and everybody's happy.
Happy. He's so happy, happy.
Bathing in the water.
Bathing in the water
of the Nile. We'll go bathing in the water.
Bathing in the waters of the Nile.
And we're back with Animal Voices, 102.7 FM in Vancouver. The research, Rinko's Research Society was founded in 1981 to conduct year-round research on the acoustics of the orca of the British Columbia coast. And over the years, the mandate of this society has broadened to include their concerns over fish farms. In 1987, the first corporate fish farms arrived in the archipelago. And in a few short years, huge problems began to appear, including toxic blooms of algae and enormous disease occurrence, parasites in the salmon, and hundreds and even thousands of seals and sea lions shot. We have on the line Alexander Morton of the Rain Coast Research Society, and if you'd like to visit our website right now, you can log on at www.raincoastresearch.org. That's raincoastresearch.org, all one word. Now, considering your primary interest in orcas, I wonder if you might have some opinion or give us some your opinion of the threatened coastal oil and gas exploration and the seismic testing that's done there in order to achieve this, which has some impact on the whales. Could you give us your opinion on that?
Well, I believe that seismic testing is going to have enormous impact on whales. I saw a similar thing happen here. It wasn't seismic testing, but the salmon farms used what were called acoustic harassment devices to try and keep seals away from their pens. And it's 198 decibel noise, which is about like standing at a jet engine at takeoff. And the whales just up and left. So they had that option. But when you create a sound as loud as seismic testing in an ocean where there's very little islands that they can hide behind or get away from, evidence shows that you actually destroy their ears and kill the animals. So they are going to kill whales. And if they pretend that this is unknown or not going to happen, I would suggest that they speak with some of the researchers who are actually doing this work. It's going to be very, very serious to the whales and dolphins of this coast.
Yeah. And these acoustic harassment devices didn't even work, after all, getting back to that. They actually acted as a dinner bell eventually, didn't they?
Yes, it's called the dinner bell effect. The seals learned to come to those devices because they knew there would be fish there. And
You know, this is a tragedy that keeps repeating with the salmon farming industry. They actually displaced the killer whales out of here using a device that didn't even serve them any purpose. The whales still aren't back because whales are very conservative animals. A lot of the matriarchs have passed on since then. I don't think anybody really knows how to fish this place anymore amongst the killer whale societies of this area. You look at the salmon farms themselves, the majority of them are losing money. They're actually in these waters, losing money, destroying wild stocks around them. Again, they're doing something that isn't working for them and isn't working for us. So it's a difficult business to understand as to why they're so tenacious and why they insist in remaining in such vital habitat of this coast.
Yeah, and you say no one has successfully farmed a carnivore. Could you explain that?
Well, it would be like farming wolves, raising chickens, feeding them to the wolves, eating the wolves. We just don't do that. It doesn't make good sense. It's not economically viable.
So there's a net loss of protein, is there?
It's a net loss of protein. You know, whereas fish farming has gone on for tens of thousands of years using fish that eat vegetable matter, and that's proved very successful in many Asian countries. You have your vegetable crop, and then you've got your fish crop, and you alternate them. You feed the fish vegetables. You know, then you're actually making protein. This salmon farming isn't actually making food. It's removing food from the environment.
Yeah, I take it that there's about a 5-to-1 ratio. I'd heard earlier that it was about a 2.5 pound ratio. That it takes 2.5 pounds of wild fish to feed to put on a pound of salmon. But on your website, I noticed this figure is 5-to-1, which is even more alarming.
It depends on whether you're using a dry weight or a wet weight, and I think they've got it down even lower. But I was on a salmon farm last month, and I was reading the labels on the bags, and what really shocked me is the first item was fish meal. The second item was poultry meal.
Oh, my God.
The third item was fish oil. And the fourth item was poultry fat.
Good heavens.
So this is the jumbling of the food chain that led to mad cow disease. So
yes.
I don't know what they're thinking here, but they're getting their protein wherever they can.
Well, as a matter of fact, I've mentioned this before in our show, that Mr. Odd Grideland, who's an executive heritage salmon in B.C., said, there will come a time when our industry will use more of the fish oil and fish meal than is available. Our biggest challenge is to find substitute grains for fish meals and fish oil. Now, doesn't that sound like saying, well, we're destroying the wild fishery, sure, but for the sake of money, but in the future sometime we're going to find a way to turn salmon into vegetarians?
I know. It's a little bit of reinventing the wheel, and Odd's completely right. I know. I mean, why wipe out those fish if they're going to be wiped out and you're going to have to switch anyway? Why don't you switch right now? But second of all, why not start with a vegetarian fish? Mm-hmm. And if you've got to have a pink fish, dye those pink, because the farm fish are dyed pink. They're actually a grayish color. So there's a lot of the logic here I don't get, but then, you know, I'm not a business person, and, you know, maybe something is working here for them. But the insidious thing is that a choice is being made every single day out here in the water, and that choice is favoring the farm fish and impacting the wild fish. And I just, you know, I don't want to impact a business. I don't have a problem with farming salmon. If that's what they want to do, fine, do it. But they better make sure, and the British Columbia public better make sure, that they never want those wild salmon again, because it's a gift that we simply won't be given again. They're very hard to bring back from extinction.
There's such a web of life here, too, isn't there? From the salmon to the seals, to the orcas, to the bears, to the forest.
Yes.
And if you break one, you corrupt everything. And with the impacts on with clear-cut farming and the impact that has on streams with landslides and so on, can you discuss a little bit about that vital link that even includes the seals and the orcas?
Yeah, it includes us, too.
And us, yes.
I didn't know very much about salmon before the sea lice issue, and now I've been following them for 5 years, and what a remarkable animal. They literally are the bloodstream of this coast. They go to sea, they pick up all this nutrient from the open ocean, basically the product of photosynthesis over the huge surface of the ocean, and they pack that into a delicious flesh and carry it back to us, back to our boats, back to our towns, and then on up the rivers. they feed the bears, they feed the eagles, they feed the wolves. They've actually found the phosphorus of pink salmon in mountain goats. But they also feed the other species of salmon. Now, many fisheries managers I've heard say, you know, if you want to bring the coho and the chinook and the steelhead back, just enhance the pinks. Just make sure the pinks are there. And they move more tonnage of nutrients up the water sheds, which are, of course, shedding everything all the time. All those rivers would be starved for food if you didn't have an animal like the pink salmon just bringing it up there, just powering it upstream. And they produce in such numbers that we can harvest them commercially. We have done so for over 100 years, mercilessly. We've taken them just as much as we can. And yet still in areas where they're allowed to get in and spawn, they're still doing great. And I look to Alaska and parts of the BC coast. And this is not a fish that's dying off. This is not a weak-hearted animal. It can take a lot and really provide for everything around it. I don't understand why we would lay it to waste.
And I guess the animals leave their droppings in the forest, and there's other ways that the fish fertilize the actual forest and all the bacteria and small life that's necessary for the health of the forest.
Yes, all those little guys that keep everything running. That's right.
Now, let's get to the sea lice. You're suing the government. Who are you suing, actually? Because there's so many involved.
I'm not actually suing them.
Oh.
It's very interesting. The Fisheries Act is a remarkable piece of legislation. And when the Parliament wrote this act, they actually inserted into it what's called a private prosecution. A private citizen such as myself, if I feel that the government has overlooked or not noticed or is avoiding some issue, I can take this to court myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Parliament understood the valuable nature of fish resources, the controversial nature of them.
This is federal parliament?
What's that?
The feds?
Yes.
Yes, okay.
That's right. It was written. It's a federal act.
Yes.
And I think that they depended on the public to be the eyes and the ears and the conscience, because the Fisheries Act controls all levels of government. It's extremely powerful. And from my point of view, I see it as an opportunity, as a tool, and why wouldn't I pick it up and use it? I tried writing letters. I tried every government process that's been available. I've had meetings. I've gone to lunch with the farmers. I've talked with people in government. I've published 5 scientific papers simply on sea lice, and nothing's worked. So this is just another tool to an end. And the end is, let's figure out a different way to fish farm. It's not to get rid of the farm. Let's figure out something different. But in the meantime, let's make sure the wild fish are still here, because I think that salmon farming is a flash in the pan. I don't see it as a sustainable industry, and maybe it is, and I could be mistaken on that. But if it goes under, we really want to make sure we've got those wild fish.
Now, most of this fish is going to the United States. Some 90%, I think, of the fisheries that are the fish that are caught go to the United States, or not the farm fish, I mean, do.
Yeah.
And they're owned by multinationals.
Yeah.
Who are these people? And
why? They're very big.
They're plundering our resource, and
yeah.
Our government seems to be in some sort of collusion with this. Because
I
understand you've had quite a bit of stonewalling by government in various efforts that you've undertaken.
Yes, tremendous stonewalling. But the companies to answer that question are huge, mm-hmm. and one of the companies in the archipelago here is Stolt, and they are actually a chemical tanking corporation, and salmon farming is a very small part of them. The other company is Heritage, and it's owned by the Weston family,
oh.
So it is Canadian-owned, but mm-hmm. there's other Nutreco, Marine Harvest, large companies that are based in Norway.
I see.
And myself, I think salmon farming is more about oil. It's more about logging the watersheds, damming the rivers, diverting fresh water to the United States, because...
Really?
If they could successfully wean the British Columbia public off of their wild salmon...
Yes.
And get them to accept these salmon that are in a pen, then they could do anything they want with the rivers and the coastal shelf. And so I see these companies in here not making money, but have huge tanking tankers.
Yeah.
I can't help but think this is about, like many issues on Earth, is about oil and exploitation. So I really, I could be wrong, but I don't think it's about food.
No, I think you're right. And I see a picture here which is taken from the air of these fish pens. And they're basically prisons for the fish, who are migratory, after all. Now, what happens in overcrowded populations, in any population?
Well, this is it. Anytime you crowd an animal, the little guys have a heyday. And by little guys, I mean the parasites, bacteria, viruses. Salmon farms, the best thing that's happened to fish pathogens since the glaciers receded. They've got hosts that are easy to jump to. They can multiply. And so what's happening with the sea lice is extremely simple. Wild fish come in. They infect the farm fish with sea lice. Wild fish go into the rivers, and the sea lice die because nature made it so that sea lice can't take fresh water. So in the spring, when the little, particularly the little pinks and chums, which come out right away, whereas all the other salmon stay in fresh water for a year or more, little pinks and chums come out, and they have no armor. They have no scales. They're naked. And nature has made sure there's no lice. But now the lice that got onto the farm fish in the fall have reproduced over several generations, and the water temperature is starting to rise in the spring. The daylight hours are longer. All of this stimulates reproduction, and pretty soon you have 50 million sea lice coming out of every single salmon farm every single month.
Great.
And the little pinks and chums are running into these clouds. I mean, you can imagine maybe a 20-pound mosquito coming at us. This is sort of the scale it's on for them. And these little sea lice are designed to attach to a salmon. That's their preferred species. And so they make a lunch of all these little pinks and chums. It's very simple science. You go to places where there's no farms. This isn't happening. You take the farm fish out of the farms here. It doesn't happen. You put the farm fish back. It starts happening again. I think DFO is ludicrous in pretending that this is a complex issue. Now, for sure, there are complexities that will increase or decrease lice, but salt doesn't make lice, rain doesn't make lice, but the salmon farms do. They actually make lice, and so this is what my private prosecution is based on. The Fisheries Act very clearly says you're not allowed to release fish into the environment, and the reason for this is when you release any kind of a fish into the environment, and that includes crustaceans and marine fish and other species, when you do that, you upset the natural balance. And whoever wrote that act understood that. And that's all that's happening. The natural balance is being upset. And it's a technical problem. They just need a barrier. There's ways of dealing with this. And so if the fish farmers really want to farm salmon, they can do it. But the way they're doing it right now, they're making the public foot the bill. And that, I just don't think is right.
The BC Indian chiefs have also called for closed containment farming. Now, that doesn't address the humane concerns, I think. It also doesn't address the concerns about it being an inefficient industry, because you're still feeding a carnivore.
I know. There's many issues involved, and one thing a person will find when they get onto the front line, such as I am right now, is you better just pick a small piece of ground to stand on, because you're going to have a hard enough time defending that. And so I really don't address those issues. I agree. There's many unethical things, of course, happening on Earth, and I kind of have to just let them all blow by me and concentrate on this one thing, because the darn thing is I've fallen in love with these wild salmon. I have fallen in love with this place. It is in me, and I think that women fighting for their homes generally put up pretty tough opposition because we don't want to move.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just an act of love, and I really don't want to impact fish farmers' jobs. I don't want to close an industry down. I know people are struggling on this coast, but British Columbia needs wild salmon. Our tourism industry needs it. Our commercial fisheries need it. Our First Nations, it's part of their soul to destroy it. When all around the world, what they would do to have 3 million pink salmon coming back to a few rivers right by their home. I mean, the fact that Vancouver has salmon swimming right through the city, people know how wonderful a gift that is. It's amazing. These fish put up with a lot. But, you know, the odd thing is just too much for them, and this is too much. So, I mean, the salmon actually don't ask for us to change that much behavior. They just need a little bit. And, boy, do they ever prosper and thrive and create life all around them.
Now, the provincial government has recently changed things a bit. For example, it says that it might create fish farm zones across the central and north coast. And within these zones, application procedures are going to be much easier. So this is, once it's been identified as a zone, apparently it's going to be pretty hard not to see it populated to the max.
Yes, well, all I can suggest is the people in those zones better decide what they want and just, you know, hold the line right now, because once they get in the water, there's just no getting them out. You know, like I said, I've tried everything. We're just asking these guys to move over a little bit. We're not even asking them to get out, and they're just laughing at us. And every year that they stall, we lose more and more of the wild salmon DNA and makes the species weaker and weaker. And so the British Columbia coast makes salmon. I mean, we're one of the last places on Earth, other than the other side of the Pacific. The Atlantic has destroyed their fish. We just haven't had the chance to do it yet. And to in this day and age, destroy an animal that's this valuable to all of us, I don't know. I don't see the sense of it. I don't even see the reason for it.
Yeah, now, the scaly fish protect, or the scales on the fish protect the large salmon, but are they also suffering casualties in the fish farms from these sea lice infestation?
I don't know. I'm just fishing the little ones and looking at them, and the bigger a fish is, the more lice it can take, and I know from talking to fishermen in the Broughton, they're seeing the Chinook and other species with juvenile lice all over them, which isn't good. I don't know if it's actually killing them. But there's viral epidemics going on in here. There's bacterial epidemics going on in here. I just can't study at all, and viruses and bacteria are very scary things to study because, of course, you have to touch them and collect them and bring them into your home, and I don't really want to do that. But a couple of years ago, seven whole farms here died of a virus called IHN. It's in the rabies family. It's a wild disease. But in the wild, a fish gets sick, a predator takes it out. They're not allowed to collect. But here, for example, this one farm site, there were so many fish dying, they couldn't get them all out. There was offal wafting into the water, and amongst this was all the herring going into Kinkam Inlet to spawn. We know that 25% of herring challenged with IHN die. Fisheries and Oceans Canada did nothing, absolutely nothing. I mean, I was writing the fish farmers, you guys need some help getting these things out. You need to put bags around your farm just to contain this. But there's, you know, there's no containing anything like that with a net. The virus has just passed right through, like there's nothing there at all. So there's serious issues that would be affecting large salmon. We've lost our Chinook in here, and Chinook aren't tiny when they go to sea, and I doubt we lost them due to sea lice. They're gone, and of course nobody knows why. And that's often the case with fish, because dead fish sink and you don't see them. And salmon farming would never exist on land. I mean, there'd be these huge smears of waste and animals with sores and strays getting out. It would never happen on land. It's just happening because we can't see it.
Well, what can we do about it? Can we help you in some way to facilitate what you're doing?
It's a very important thing people can do, and people often forget that they're absolutely in control of these runaway corporations. Just unplug them. Don't buy it.
Boycott.
Yeah. Tell your friends, don't buy it.
It's an inferior product, too, isn't it? In many ways, it's full of drugs and antibiotics, which cause devastating problems, including problems in health, human health.
That's what I understand. That's not my work. But if you go to the website Farmed and Dangerous, there's a lot of information there about it. And, you know, I think in many directions, corporations have it's just gone to their head. They will just do whatever it takes to make money. And if we say we don't want this product, they'll do something else. It won't destroy the economy. We're a very remarkable animal that way. We do figure things out. So, yeah, just don't buy it and educate yourself and tell the people who trust you and who know you, please don't buy this until it's safe. And, you know, maybe the salmon farmers decide they really do want to farm salmon and they'll step up and do closed containment. But I think more likely they'll just switch to a more suitable fish and do it in a different way.
The NDP's record and the Liberals' record has not been good, in my opinion. I think perhaps the Green Party... at least their platform seems far more rational.
Yes, I know. I mean, I got all these farms with the NDP, and I understand they've changed their minds on it, and actually pretty well every riding that has fish farms in it, the Liberal MLAs were voted out. So that's a significant message. To be honest, I think the government's finding the salmon farming industry to be a bit of a millstone around their neck, and they just don't know how to get out of it. But I'm just totally guessing there. I certainly would feel that way if I was them.
All right, we'll see if we can give them a little push. Thanks very much. Thank you very much, Alexandra Morton.
Bye-bye.
Bye. That was Alexandra Morton of the raincoastresearch.org. If you want to look it up on the website, beautiful website, including pictures of the sea lice and the damage that they do. So I'd advise you to have a look at raincoastresearch.org and support her in any way you can.
Thank you for that, John. Very interesting interview. Now, I guess we're getting very near the end of our time, so I'll have to sign off for Animal Voices, and I would suggest that you listen to a replay or get your friends to listen to a replay of the broadcast on Monday, 4 to 5 p.m., and thank you so much for listening, and we will be back this coming Friday at noon. Website is www.animalvoices.org, and the program will be posted there as soon as possible. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Stay tuned. Coming up in just about 2 minutes' time is going to be the Green Monkey Environmental Radio and Co-op Radio. We'll go out from Animal Voices with a little bit more music by Dana Lyons. We'll hear at least part of his great, famous song, Cows with Guns.
Fat and docile, big and dumb, they look so stupid, they aren't much fun. Cows aren't fun. They eat to grow, grow to die, die to be et at the hamburger fry. Cows well done. Nobody thunk it, nobody knew, no one imagined the great cow guru. Cows are one. He hid in the forest, read books with great zeal. He loved Che Guevara, a revolutionary veal. Cows a tongue. He spoke about justice, but nobody stirred. He felt like an outcast, alone in the herd. Cowed all drums. He mooed, we must fight, escape or we'll die. Cows gathered around, cause the stakes were so high. Bad cow pun. But then he was captured, stuffed into a crate, loaded onto a truck where he rode to his fate. Cows are bummed. He was a scrawny calf who looked rather woozy. No one suspected he was packing an Uzi. Cows with guns. They came with a needle to stick in his thigh. He kicked for the groin. He pissed in their eye. Cow well hung. Knocked over a tractor and ran for the door. 6 gallons of gas flowed out on the floor. Run, cows, run. He picked up a bullhorn and jumped up on the hay. We are free-roving bovines. We run free today.
We will fight for bovine freedom and hold our large heads high. We will run free with the buffalo or die. Cows with guns.
Crashed the gate in a great stampede, tipped over milk truck, torched all the feed. Cows have fun. 60 police cars were piled in a heap, covered in cow pies, covered up deep. Much cow dung. Black smoke rising, darkening the day. 12 burning McDonald's, have it your way.
We will fight for bovine freedom and hold our large heads high. We will run free with the buffalo or die. Cows with guns.
The president said, enough is enough. These uppity cattle, it's time to get tough. Cow dung flung. The newspapers gloated, folks sighed with relief. Tomorrow at noon, they would all be ground beef. Cows on buns. Cows outgunned. The order was given to turn cows to whoppers, enforced by the might of 10,000 coppers. But on the horizon, surrounding the shoppers, came the deafening roar of chickens in choppers.
We will fight for bovine freedom and hold our large heads high. We will run free with the buffalo or dog.
Oh,
cows with guns.